Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 98 with my guest, Ed Krasnick. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, 90 minutes of honesty about all the battles in our heads. From medically diagnosed conditions and past traumas to everyday compulsive negative thinking. The show is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. It's not a doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room filled with conversations you've always wanted to have, but didn't really know how to start. Or maybe you were too embarrassed. Maybe you were too drunk. It's gone off the rails already. The website for this show is mentalpod.com. That's also the Twitter name you can follow me at. Go to the website. Join the forum. A lot of people connecting to each other on the forum. And that's a really cool thing. There's other stuff on the website that I can't think of right now. But there's blogs that you can read that I've written, that other people have written. And there's a bunch of surveys. There's probably 8 different surveys you can take. And you can also see how other people have responded on the surveys. Literally, like the Shame and Secret survey, I think we were approaching 3,000 people having taken that survey. And it's fascinating what other people keep in the kind of hidden that they're afraid to share with other people. And I've always find it fascinating going through there and seeing how alike we really are. I want to give a shout out to a listener, Hannah Roberts, who won the Hurt 100 Ultra Marathon. That's right. They run 100 miles through the mountains of Hawaii. And she dedicated her run to the Mental Illness Happy Hour. And I appreciate that. She was also the winner last year, and she sent me a really nice note how when she was about 60 miles into it and kind of hit a wall, that she thought back on the episode with Nadarey Fanoian, the Iranian freedom fighter, and she thought about all of the battles that Nadarey had to fight in her life, and she used that as inspiration to keep going. And I just think that's fucking awesome. So congratulations, Hannah. Wanted to mention the episode with Lilith. There was some controversy as to whether or not she was right when she said that if you've ever taken lithium as a woman, you're at risk for having a child with birth defects. That is not the case. That is not. In fact, you can even be on lithium and the risk is still very, very small that your child will have any type of birth defect. But there is no risk having had lithium in your past. I think if you're on lithium and you're pregnant, the risk is like 1 in 5,000 for the baby having some type of hurt thing. But I would not use this podcast as a place to find out information like that. I am a jackass that tells dick jokes. Pretty sweet ones, but they're dick jokes. And that brings me to this email I want to read from Maya Stone. She says, during the recent episode with Elizabeth Lame, she mentioned that she was trying to get pregnant and therefore was not taking any antidepressants. As a doctor, mother, and someone who suffers from depression, I want to make sure that women are talking to their doctors and being honest with themselves about their depression symptoms before deciding to go off medication for pregnancy. I stopped my medication for my first pregnancy and was miserable. I resented my unborn child for making me fat and tired and often regretted getting pregnant. I finally broke down and restarted my meds a week before I gave birth. I stayed on my meds during my second pregnancy and had a much better experience. Many antidepressants have a very small risk of adverse effects on the fetus, and that should be weighed against 9 months of depression. So thank you for that, Maya. This was not an email, but this was somebody filled out at the end of a survey, and I wanted to read it. This is from a guy who calls himself Taquito, and he says, I don't understand how people have money. The guests who got help went to a hospital, live in a house, speak with a therapist, purchase medications, etc. How do they pay for these things? Being depressed much of the time over the past decades has made it difficult for me to build a career or earn any money, not to mention wasting money on various things when my mind was not right. But I am not permanently disabled, and I keep trying again, working at something like a job or graduate school program until I get depressed and generally fucked up in the head to where I cannot continue with it. Now I work full-time and must pay off debts and try to keep paying my bills and cannot see how to pay for an appointment with a counselor when that fee would totally fuck up my math problem, and I just fear that it will not help me. So it would be self-indulgent and self-destructive. Maybe this is all evidence that I need to get more help. I guess all this could be said more easily, like, how about addressing financial difficulties, which are sometimes caused by mental illness, exacerbated by mental illness, and are a barrier to treatment? If a person is many thousands in debt, has obligations like children, rent, and bills, and just barely makes it with a low-paying job, is it even advisable for this person to spend $75 on a sliding scale fee or whatever it is for one to visit a middle-class professional to ask how they are feeling? This is what I am turning over in my head these days, knowing I need help, feeling that I do deserve help, but not sure it is the right thing for me to do because of the expense. Thank you, Taquito, for that. That was actually perfectly worded. I am lucky enough to have insurance, to be able to see a therapist and a psychiatrist, and I still sometimes find myself fighting the urge when I'm depressed to go for help because it's like sandpaper, talking about it. It feels like a wound, opening it up and talking about it again because you don't know where the truth actually lies. It's a tangled bowl of spaghetti, and am I being a baby? Am I just feeling sorry for myself? Is this actually depression? Is it because I've been too selfish lately? What is really going on with me? And sometimes it just feels like it's easier to just sleep and ignore it. So you throw a money problem on top of that. I wish I had an answer to that, Taquito. I just like calling you Taquito. I wish I had an answer to that, and that is a letter that I would like to have somebody read in front of Congress, because I think there are millions of people that feel just the same way you do. This may or may not be helpful, this email I got from somebody, but they found a way that kind of worked for them, and this is from Randy Huff. And he says, I've been calling around and hitting some walls, which can be demotivating when trying to do anything. Some primary care doctors won't see you for, quote, mental health, and not all will accept cash. Some of the sliding scale places don't treat mental health. And one that did isn't taking new patients. But here I am 10 days later, and I had a stroke of genius last night. I had visited urgent care centers before, so I called one up and asked if they could prescribe antidepressants, and they said yes. I went and saw a doctor. It cost $90, and they gave me one refill and asked that I come back in 3 weeks or see a primary care physician in 3 weeks. The prescription was for 20 milligrams of Celexa, and Target filled that prescription for $4 off their generic plan. It is not the end-all answer, but a step in the good direction. I feel incredibly accomplished today and on a high. Yes, I know I'll crash down to reality at some point, but right now I feel a sort of success. I'm still trying to find a better location to treat my mental illness. They also recommend calling 211 for counseling from any landline. So they said that that number will help you find counseling in your area. Thank you for that, Randall. And I did try that from my landline, and it is, I believe, a nationwide number where you will get somebody who can help direct you to any type of community service that there is in your area, be it mental health facility, you know, to a dog that won't stop barking. But that is good to know. So if you're sitting there and you're just really feeling frustrated, dial 211 from a landline and just start talking to somebody. Maybe it will lead you to help. It doesn't hurt to try. And I think, like Randall said, at least you feel like you're moving forward. And before we get to the interview with Ed Krasnick, by the way, we recorded the interview about a year or a year and a half ago. And one of the reasons why I kind of held on to it for so long was I think it's a great interview, but after it was over, I felt like I worried that I didn't get enough childhood stuff from his story. And I found myself wanting to know more about that. So I felt like it was kind of incomplete. And then just for some reason, I decided to play it last night. And I felt differently. And I felt like, no, it's he gives some snapshots of his childhood that I think paint a lovely picture for us. So I'm posting it, and he's just a great guy, funny guy, Ed Krasnick. Right now I'm panicking that the intro is way too fucking long, and anybody that enjoys this show has stopped listening. I want to read an email, and then we'll get to the interview with Ed. This is an email I got from a listener named Fiona, and she writes, I'm a singer and an artist, and I listen to podcasts like yours while mopping floors and cleaning toilets at my housekeeping day job. I've been feeling pretty depressed and hopeless for the past couple of days. Today, as I finished a good hour or two of ruminating about the past and worrying about the future, I decided to try writing a letter of encouragement to myself. You are stronger than you know. You have been to hell and back, and you are still moving forward. You have the ability to let it go. To let the past be the past and the future, with all its unknowns, be the future. You are here, now, in this moment. And you can use this moment to do good, provide service, create something beautiful, and enrich a life, whether it is your own or someone else's. Share your gifts with the world around you, and let the world within you grow.
Every human being has weird thoughts going through their head.
Oh God, that's so embarrassing.
I'm afraid I'll never get another job again.
That I will die and will have not been special.
My brain has the gift of seeing the terrible.
A million-pound tourniquet being turned against my chest that was constant.
Then I started sabotaging my own career.
Wanting to die and...
to stop him from feeling any joy.
That is...
very uncomfortable in my own body.
I ended up becoming a male prostitute.
And what I became was an animal.
They took away my shoelaces.
I became chaos.
Like, it hurts. I just want to go. I just want to leave.
You have no idea what a small part of your life this is.
If you go to a support group, it's like creating a family that you didn't have.
I mean, life is 1% event.
My body was abused.
99% judgment about that event.
But they couldn't touch the best parts of me.
But the world is a little bit wounding. It's also glorious.
It does always get better. It really does.
I'm here with Ed Krasnick. Do you still go by Crazy Eddie Krasnick?
I did in college, and I have, my wife calls me those three names. Does not call me Ed, does not call me Crazy. It is all three consecutively in a row. That was my nickname. My nickname in college was Crazy Eddie.
Are you serious?
Yeah, Crazy Eddie.
I was just kidding.
No, it's true. It's Crazy Eddie. And because you know, when you're institutionalized, people, you get a name.
Were you institutionalized?
No, but if you were, no, but I have other stuff. Yeah. That's not that, but there's other stuff.
Yes, you and I have talked. Ed is a stand-up comedian, an actor, a podcaster. You may have seen him on The Sopranos. He was the stand-up comedian performing bad jokes at the retirement home in that episode of The Sopranos. You've seen him do stand-up. He's got a podcast called This Week in Comedy, and just a great guy and very open and honest about what he's gone through. When I came to do your podcast, we couldn't stop talking about what it's like to suffer from depression and mental illness and how it affects being creative and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it was natural that you were going to come on the podcast. It was just a matter of when and where, but you're here now and I'm glad you're here.
Well, me too. I appreciate it.
You are from, I want to say,
Monroe, Louisiana. No, I'm from Boston, Massachusetts.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm from a long line of mentally ill Jews, if I can put it that way. We have T-shirts. I'm sorry. You weren't expecting
that. I just
that.
Wasn't.
And you weren't ready for it.
There's also a way Jewish people hit the word Jew. That never doesn't make me laugh. Did you ever see when Don Rickles,
was on Larry King?
I tell people about that all the time.
Larry, you're a Jew.
Larry, you're a Jew. And then Larry, who was hosting a program that was live, goes under the table. You can't see him.
Yeah.
I didn't know where he went. For like 2 minutes, he was gone.
Never doesn't make me laugh because there's just I suppose in some way, that pronunciation of it is kind of when black people call each other the N-word, like when Jewish people hit that word, there's just a, you know, that there's just that, you know, that they've lived something or I don't know. It just strikes me as just makes me laugh.
No, I know. It you have a hard J sound.
Yeah.
And it ends in ooh.
Ooh. How can it not be funny?
Yeah, it's really, you know, when they were called that, they were made to be funny and had really no choice, and also had no choice with the mental illness.
Yeah.
What's given to them? No, I mean,
is it fair to say that the Jewish culture is a very mentally demanding in and of itself? Now, forget about how people outside the Jewish culture treat Jews, but a lot of the Jewish people that I have met, and this is usually how sentences begin before someone is fired later.
Yeah, a lot of the Jewish people I have met.
There is a premium is placed on education, on and go, 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 achieve, 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 and we will accept nothing less than awesome.
Yes, and okay. Introspection, and self-reflection,
mm-hmm.
but also self-criticism.
Yes.
Self-criticism and self-reflection. And what you don't get to do as a Jewish person, I mean, I went to yeshiva, I went to Hebrew day school. Mm-hmm. What you don't get to do is there's a mysticism part of Judaism. Mm-hmm. There's Kabbalah and there's a mysticism and there's a fire and a spirituality. But they don't let you, you don't go near that.
Why not?
Because you're not supposed to read that book till you're 40.
Really? Because
you don't understand it. It's very complex.
I would agree that there are things that you can't grasp until you're near that age,
right.
But I don't understand why you would tell somebody to not even go near it until you're 40.
You're not supposed to do it because you're not allowed to have pleasure. No, I mean, you're not allowed to have flavor or pleasure. These are the two things. No, I mean, the thing about it is that there's a bunch of different things. One is we're talking about spirit. You say, you know, spirituality, and there's a great fire and a great spirit, and there's storytelling, and there's culture, and there's passion. But there's also we're outsiders. We're not part of it. And we don't feel that we belong.
And not just outsiders for a brief period of time.
Right.
You know,
right. It's
you guys are the original outsiders.
Yeah. We were in the S.E. Hinton. S.E. Hinton wrote a book about us. And the people in the movie, of course, were not cast. They weren't Jews who were cast. Because you never cast Jews to play Jews or lawyers to play, you know how it is. But I think, you know, I think the thing is, if, and I, you know, this is a weird way to get into it, but if you believe that you're your brain, if you believe that what we are is the brain, that the brain runs your life, your mind runs your life, you're going to be very unhappy.
Very unhappy, very confused, very sad, and feel very controlled.
Yes. And you're going to spend your whole, you know, you spend your whole life believing that you have control over everything and that you will yes. try to control everything.
And you will try to will. And there are people who can't achieve some semblance of it. People like, I keep talking about this book constantly, but I'm reading Steve Jobs' biography. And here is a guy who literally willed things into existence, but was in many ways one of the most pathetic human beings I've ever read about in interpersonal relations.
Well, you know, there's something, the other thing is, you know, when I used to hear all these terms, I thought, oh, it's woo-woo, it's touchy-feely, it's nobody knows about it. Balance. Incredible people, incredibly gifted people are not balanced. They're not balanced.
Yeah.
And that's part of their gift. But what people don't learn is they don't learn how to be balanced. We don't learn how to be balanced. We don't learn that our emotions are actually something that want to move through us. Mm-hmm. They don't want to stay. They don't want to be controlled. They don't want to be part of your body. They don't want to stay in your liver. They actually want to move out. And if you welcome them instead of resist them, they go away, they leave you, and they move on. And that's that, you know, but who understands that? Who practices that? Who learns that?
Nobody teaches us that. And so I think what we do and what I often do is when an uncomfortable emotion comes to me, I try to act my way out of that emotion or think my way out of that emotion instead of just embracing that and saying, oh, look, I'm feeling sad, or oh, look, or talking about it.
And it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, there's no meaning attached to it.
Do you think the most obsessive compulsive behavior is somebody trying to escape feeling an emotion?
You know, I'm not an expert. I mean, it could be. I think in some instances, whether you're trying to escape it, control it. You want to control it.
Which you can't.
You want to control things and you want to understand things. That's mm-hmm. the other thing.
Yeah.
We have to, and understanding is another way of controlling. You know, there's this guy, this teacher, the Sedona method. There's a tool. It's actually a very good,
what do you call it?
Sedona method.
Right.
It's a very good tool, uh-huh. and it's a releasing technique. And it postulates that the only reason to understand your problems is because you're planning on having them again.
Hmm.
Why would you need to understand them if you weren't planning on having them again?
Yeah, I suppose so. That makes total sense.
And there's a lot of effort that goes into understanding. Like, where did it come from? Why did it persist? You know, it's not important where it came from. What's important is that you're here now, and you can let go of it.
I want to go back to what you said about this identifying that your mind is who you are. That, to me, was one of the biggest breakthroughs that I've had, was learning to disidentify from my mind. And I learned by reading Eckhart Tolle's book, A New Earth, and A Power of Now is also a great book, but A New Earth to me is just one of the greatest books about the mind and the ego ever written. And if you begin to disidentify from your mind and realize that your thoughts aren't who you are, that you don't have control necessarily over what thoughts pop into your head, but what you do have control over is how long you let them linger and how long you just play with them. You then have a chance to tap into this other part of our being. And I know this sounds like a bunch of horse shitty new age stuff, but you have then a chance to feel your spirit instead of your mind. And I believe, as many people do, that we are not human beings. We are not bodies with the spirit. We're spirits with the body. And the spirit, in my opinion, always has to lead, because if the spirit is ignored, I believe that the mind and the body wither and suffer, and it's all downhill from there.
Well, I don't know if it's been this way throughout the history of the world, but certainly in this time, there's a lot of stress. There's a lot of trying to control stress. There's a lot of panic. Which is not fear, it's panic, which is, I don't want to feel the fear.
Right.
I want to control the fear.
And I got to get rid of it right now.
Yeah. What am I going to do? And there's
I can't be patient with this feeling.
No, because I'm going to die, because I have, you know, it's not a good picture. And so I'm going to resist what I don't want to happen instead of open up to what I do want to happen. I'm mm-hmm. going to resist what I don't want to not be able to pay the rent. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to talk about not being able to pay the rent.
Right.
That's what I'm picturing is I can't pay it. And I don't want that to happen. Instead of, you know, I'm going to let that go. I'm not going to picture not paying the rent.
But how do you get to that point, Ed, without calling yourself irresponsible for not obsessing about the rent? Because most people would say, if I'm not obsessing about the rent that I can't pay, I'm being a douchebag, I'm being irresponsible, and I'm not dealing with reality.
Okay, here's the other spin on it, though. If I'm panicking, I'm dead to other people. I'm dead to myself, and I'm dead to other people.
Right.
So when I'm sitting here across from you and I'm panicking, I'm not here. You know, when people say it's not all about you, actually it is all about you. It's all about you, because what you are, you take with you into life, into every person you come in contact with. So if you're withholding something, you're helping other people to withhold.
Mm-hmm.
You're helping other people to be not their full potential. So it is all about me. And there's no other people out there. We're all reflections of each other. So there's one person, and it is all about me. You know, but you say, like the panicking, don't you want to be, you know, responsible, and are you going to be a douchebag? You're not going to pay the rent. Panicking will not make you pay the rent.
No, it won't.
It does not bring you the rent.
No.
In fact, quite the opposite. It brings you not being able to pay the rent.
Because what might happen is in those 2 days where you're wondering how you're going to pay the rent, you're so unpresent in your conversation with somebody for something unrelated to the rent. Maybe that person was thinking about hiring you for a job, but you are so unpleasant to be around. You're so wrapped up in your own bullshit. That never has a chance to happen. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard of people that when they get in touch with their spiritual side, for lack of a better word, in other words, disidentify from their mind and just try to be present in every moment and not give in to fear, not trip on the past or the future, but just look whoever you're talking to in the eye and be present. Those people's lives have a way of working out that is amazing. And it tells me there is something going on that we can't see, that is too sophisticated for us to put our finger on, but when we just treat each other with dignity and try not to be controlled by our fear, pathways open up. That shit gets taken care of.
As it is meant to do.
Yes.
There is, you know, when I'm withholding stuff and I'm trying to control stuff and I'm panicking, I'm riding around in a car with the emergency brake on. That's the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's a big deal. Everything is a chore. It's never going to get better.
Now, we're talking a sedan, an SUV, Volt?
In my case, it would be the car that the nuns used in The Flying Nun, which is a side panel like a Woody.
A Woody, yeah.
But it's a Woody that has flat tires. It's a Woody that is not souped up. It's actually souped down. This is the thing. I mean, you're riding around. It's that feeling. The car wants to go. Mm-hmm. Take your foot off the emergency brake.
That's such a great analogy. Such a great analogy.
And if you do, the car goes on its own.
It really does.
You don't have to push the pedal.
Yes,
it just goes on its own.
You become your own worst enemy, and obsessing about your fear almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It is because what happens when I'm afraid, I'm picturing, there are pictures that form, and the pictures are the things that I don't want.
Mm-hmm.
So if you let go of the pictures of the things that you don't want to happen, you open to the things that are wanting to happen.
So then how do you get rid? And I know this stuff intellectually, Ed.
Yeah, me
and,
too.
And
intellectually.
And there are many days when I can actually execute what we're talking about. But for instance, this morning, I was just walking around in doom, convinced that I'm never going to make any money again, that the house is falling apart, that my mental illness is getting worse, that I'm going to eventually become hospitalized. I mean, just really, it's all bad and it's all getting worse and I'm fucked. And I printed out this woman's list of fears, this listener who had sent me this fantastic list of fears. And I started reading some of them. Her name is Christine. And I began to feel my fear lift. I began to feel my sense of being alone lift. And it just never ceases to amaze me how quickly we can think we're the only ones going through this and that what we're experiencing is absolutely reality.
You know, because the act of doing that to yourself, and I did it on my way over here. Yeah. I do it all the time.
What were you afraid of on the way over here?
I'm afraid that people won't like me. I'm afraid that I won't be good enough, and I'm afraid that, you know, what I'm thinking about is I want your listeners to like me.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking about. I'm not thinking about, you know, be yourself. I'm not thinking about be right. real. I'm not thinking about be present.
Right.
I hope that they're driving in a car or washing the clothes, mm-hmm. and they listen to this guy and they think, "Wow, that guy's really smart and funny and great." Mm-hmm. That's what I'm thinking about. And you know what? I'm not living. Yeah. I'm not living. I'm not present, and I'm not alive. That is what being not alive is. Mm-hmm. You know.
By the way, I think those things, and it's my show. They're tuning into.
Oh, sure. Sure. No,
you know, it never ends. It's like they're coming back to listen to the show, and I'm still afraid.
Well,
yeah, they're not gonna. It's like a woman taking her clothes off to have sex with you, and you're thinking to yourself, "Boy, I just don't think she's into me."
And you're not there.
And you're not there.
And you're not there. But you know, I started doing these. Everybody's got some technique or some tool. You need people. You need to connect to other people. You need a tool. You need something that you can do.
Right.
If you don't have something that you can do, then you don't have anywhere to go.
But your brain.
Yeah, you have your brain. And that's what it's going to just go. So something, you know, I never thought about this, but, you know, the Sedona method and some other releasing techniques, welcome it. What happens with these fears and these self-fulfilling problems is it's resistance. You're resisting what is.
Mm-hmm.
And so stop resisting. So welcome it. I'm afraid. I hate myself. People never listen to my show. I can't do this. I can't. Nobody's going to like me. I'm going to bomb on Paul's show. It's going to be horrible. And you say, okay. I hear you. I welcome you. Can you be more afraid? Encourage it to be more.
Really?
And when you encourage it to be more, something very interesting happens. It goes away.
Really?
It goes away.
I've never tried that.
Encourage it. When you have a feeling in your gut, and this is starting to come, you say, wow, I see, I feel, you know, wow, I'm doing that fear thing again. I see that that's coming. You know what? Be more afraid.
Yeah.
And it's a paradox. And what happens is you start opening up. What's making you afraid is you're constricting. You're physically, you're constricting. And when you say, I'm constricting, could I make more space? Then there's more space.
How did you learn this stuff?
Well, one is the Sedona method, but for years, you know, we're comics. And while I was doing stand-up and I was trying to be in you know, doing show business, I was seeing every single person on the planet and new agey people and shaman. Mm-hmm. And crazy people and some people who are gifted and everything because I didn't like who I was and I wanted to be happy. I wanted to be at peace. I don't think that you should have to wait till the end of your life to hear the words rest in peace.
Yeah.
I think that's too late. I think you got to do it now.
I think it's the perfect time. I've got to disagree.
When you're in the casket.
Yeah. I like to build. I like to build and I like to close strong, Ed.
You close strong and then now, finally.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of that, apparently Steve Jobs' sister was describing him in his last minutes on Earth. And he was just, this relaxation came over in him and he just kept saying, he was looking at everybody around him and soaking in the love. And he just kept saying, wow, 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 wow. And I just thought, wow, here's a guy that just ran over people his whole life. And then in the last couple of minutes, and it, you know, this is my opinion. I never met the guy, never spent any time around him, but judging from this book, it's like he didn't really get the power of just sitting and being with people and not working an angle and not obsessing about a project until the last couple of minutes of his life. And
And that's what you go out with.
That's what you go out with. And I'm sure that's what was meant to be for him. We all benefited in many ways from the great products that he obsessed about. But I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to stumble onto what gets me to peace the last week I'm on Earth. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. How do we do it now and not feel like we're being irresponsible and we're being lazy? Because aren't those the two things that pop into your head when you try to tell yourself to calm down and not worry about the future?
Well, it's that I'm going to die. You know, it's that I'm going to die and I have no control. And so I'm going to die and I have no control. And so this will, with me, it will always be this way. There's a permanence to it. My life has sucked before, and it's never going to change. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. And, you know, gratefulness, being grateful has not been one of my strong suits. I don't spend a lot of time in it because I'm too busy, you know, making myself crazy.
Well, gratitude can't be faked. I've never been able to fake gratitude. I have to feel gratitude, and I can rarely feel gratitude if I'm trapped in my mind. I have to connect to something in my spirit. And when I say spirit, I mean that energy when I connect to another human being. That to me is, I'm connecting you with my spirit and not my mind. Like what you and I are doing right now. Right. Yeah, there's a little bit of intellectual stuff involved, but we're being vulnerable. We're talking about our fears. That to me is like where then the spirit in our body kind of enters into it. Sure. And that is the only kind of portal that I can get to gratitude through, is through my spirit.
Yeah, because you can't control it. I can't control it, and also it's very hard to be in your head and be grateful.
Yeah,
if you're in your head, because
your head always wants more.
Yeah, more, and there's something wrong with it, or I'm not being grateful in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you comment on it instead of just be it. But you know, we just want to be. You want to be a human being, and it's very challenging for me to be a human being and feel all this stress and feel like all these things mean something, because then you attach the meaning. I attach the meaning to it, and because I can't pay my DWP bill, it means something.
Yeah,
it means something. Not only is the electricity going to be shut off, mm-hmm. but I'm going to die. It all kind of goes to that.
Have you had that experience where you can't pay your light bill?
Up until very recently.
So walk me through.
Well, I, you know, show business, it's been very difficult for me, as it has been for most people,
yeah,
in the last few years.
Everybody's working for free.
Everybody's working for free. But there's a basic thing. The world tells me there's no money. There's no jobs. Nobody has any money. The world is going bankrupt. This is what the world tells you. And then what happens is it feeds perfectly into my sense of panic. And then what happens is I get smaller. I start to constrict. I get smaller. I don't believe there's any possibility. And I'm in the car and I can't even see 2 feet in front of me because it's horrible. I hate my, you know, it's, it's horrible. So this is the cycle of what happens. And, I lost my train of thought a little bit, but what
the light bill, unable
what,
to pay
what
the light
happens
bill.
is you're not, like you say before, you're not open to really what is, and you're not in a state of being, and it's all a lie. It's a big, you know, it's a big lie. There's plenty of money. There's plenty of work. There's plenty of all these things, but not if you're panic stricken. The economy is shifting. Yes. And people have robbed America. You know, the economy, it's real. That's shifting. But they're telling people to panic, and people are buying into it. And the biggest inventions and the best things that have ever been discovered have mostly been discovered at a time when people are telling you that there's no money. This is when inventions are born. They're born out of times when people feel scarcity. This is when they're born. So, you know, I lost my original train of thought.
The Great Depression was when the double-headed dildo was invented.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. My great-grandfather... And soon. No, it's funny. It's funny. No, this is what I was thinking of. Besides the dildo,
how the double-headed dildo was invented? A couple of hobos were fighting over a can of beans, and somebody watching thought, these two really are the perfect angle for this invention?
You know, well, this, and it was born out of a time, a man was sitting there, he was very depressed, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden he looked at that and he said, there's money here.
Yeah. I'm thinking, fuck these guys, and I thought, no, I could literally fuck both these guys at the same time.
And I'll invent something, and I know a friend, and his name is Wildo. We call him Wildo. I'm not going to call it that, but maybe a harder D would be good, because there's two D's in it, double D. The thing that I was thinking about is, for me, you have like a core belief, you have a belief about yourself.
Yes.
For me, I always struggled with the belief that I had no value.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have no value, it becomes very difficult to get money in your life.
It is.
It's amazing how that is.
Because you think, why would anybody treat me other than invisible?
And you approach people as an invisible person. You approach, or you become the ingratiating, you know, which is like, I'll ask a waitress at a restaurant, you know, I hate to bother you.
Right.
It's always our fucking job. But I hate to bother you.
Right.
Because if I say I would like a napkin, maybe she doesn't like me.
Mm-hmm.
Pushy and too demanding, mm-hmm. and not likable. So you want to be liked, have no value, believe you have no value. It's not amazing. It's like Max von Sydow and Hannah and her sisters. It's not that there are Nazis. It's, given the way things are in the world, why aren't there more Nazis? It's not why are there Nazis. It's, if you're doing this to yourself, right, and there's 8 billion people on the planet who are also doing this to themselves, how is it possible that anybody's still alive? Because it's very violent. It's very violent. And, you know, I mean, I can be, you know, I've been in such therapy, but also like the shamans and the people, and I, you know, you make fun of it, but really you pick the wrong therapist. That's the other thing. You pick people who are going to perpetuate what you're feeling, what's happening inside of you.
What percentage of people have you gone to see have been kind of full of shit and a waste of money and time?
Well, nobody's totally, there's always something in there, but I've
Who is the worst one?
It's not that, probably an analyst when I was like 17, was a guy who was divorcing from his wife at the time, was going through a divorce, and he would call me up on the phone and he would say, Mr. Edward Krasnick, it's my job to identify patterns of irresponsible behavior. Now, this was an analyst, so this was the one time where you lay on a couch and the person is behind you. You don't see them. You free associate. It's based on free associate. That's analysis. And I can't talk to somebody if I can't look at them. So my neck, I had like a neck brace because I was turning my head the whole time. And he said, just feel free to look straight out that way. And he kept moving his chair, and it was like running after him on a baseball diamond. It was like a crazy thing. So the good therapists, you know, the people that are good are people who, you know, who challenge you. And, you know, when you go make a joke in a therapy office and the woman looks at you and says, you know, I'm sure you're very funny, but I'm sure that's not why you're here. Then, you know, you're in the right. But therapy has helped me. I wouldn't be alive if it weren't for the therapists I've seen.
Sure.
But it is, what is really helping me is releasing, learning how to let go, and learning how to be more present. That's
well,
all.
Well, let's talk about like your past, your upbringing, that kind of stuff.
I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to give you a picture, and it'll tell you everything you need to know.
Okay.
Okay. Right. It's I'm like 10 years old, and I'm living in the suburbs of Boston. Maybe 10, 11 years old. And it's 8:30 in the morning, and I'm in my bedroom, which has royal blue half drapes. Royal blue was very big in this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so royal blue and a bedspread with red piping, royal blue bedspread, red piping. and so I'm laying in the bed, and I'm face down on the bed. I'm panicked beyond belief. The TV is on in my room, and it's on a desk, and it's a Philco black and white TV with a coat hanger antenna, because I used to carry it around the house to avoid talking to other people. Afraid, you know, didn't want to communicate with anybody, so would carry the TV in front of me. So I'm in the bed, and outside my bed, and I should mention, it's snowing sideways, and it's February, and it's pitch dark. This is how I remember it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm laying down, and I hear outside the window the voices of kids on their way to school. And I can't move. So, okay, now cut to later in the day, okay? So it's later in the day. My mother has been out shopping. I've been in this position all day. The TV has continued to be on all day. I'm sleeping and I'm dozing and I'm 11 years old now.
Wow.
And my mother comes home and I hear the garage door opening, okay? And the garage door is opening and I start to panic because I don't want her to think that I've been in bed all day. And I am in my pajamas and I get out of my bed like really fast and I start to like put my hair together, comb my hair because I want her to believe that even though I'm in my pajamas, I'm fine and I'm
on it. She thinks you went to school.
She knows that I'm home.
Okay.
But she
thinks that you got up and did something.
She thinks I got up and did something. But now I'm so it's a kid who is, you know, totally depressed, feels totally alone, trying to comfort himself. Doesn't know that it's okay to have feelings, thinks you're bad if you have them, thinks you're bad if you have needs, and thinks there's something desperately wrong with them and that other people aren't like that. So you got all that going on, plus no drugs, but stuffing feelings with food. The reason why I was in bed in the first place is because I watched Johnny Carson the night before, and at 11:30, I would walk back and forth to the kitchen to get more food because I was so lonely, because I would stuff my feelings, mm-hmm. and then I'd make myself so physically sick that I really couldn't get out of bed. So I was depressed, but I was depressing it with food, and I was ill. I was physically sick. So this is the cycle of the way that I lived off and on up until I was in my 30s. Whether I was living with my family or not, yeah. I was living that way. And it wasn't until I met another guy who was in a comedy group with me, and I said, and he said to me something. He said, "How are you doing?" I said, "Well, things aren't that good." He said, "Let me ask you a question. Do you hide?" And I said, "Well, I've never heard anybody ask me that before." He said, "Yeah," and we started talking. We became good friends. And he was doing the same thing. But you can't meet other people who are doing the same thing because they're hiding
unless you talk about it.
Yeah. You too? And then we'd start calling each other up on the phone and say, "How you doing?" He says, "I'm doing it. Haven't been out in 3 days, doing it." And this is a funny story, and I'll make it really brief, but I lived in San Francisco, and I lived on the parade route to Seal Rock Beach, which was Ocean Beach, which all the dignitaries, when they came to San Francisco, they would go right by my house. So outside my house, I haven't been out in a few days. I got the pajamas. I'm eating Quaker 100% natural cereal because I couldn't even allow myself to have flavor while I'm depressing the feelings. It had to be, it's natural. Well, I ate 5 boxes of it, you know? So it's not, you know, I'm naturally depressed and sick. So there I am. I'm sitting. My feet are up on a table that has a TV set, and the TV is playing. And outside, I hear a motorcade. And I open my window like a little old lady, you know, who's like looking out with a teacup. And I open the little jealousy, you know, the blinds. And I open it up and I see that French Prime Minister François Mitterrand is outside my window. And he's waving and there's a crowd and they're going by. But in back of me, I hear from my TV set the theme song to Eight is Enough. And I have a choice to make. And I closed the windows and I went back to watch Eight is Enough. That will tell you where the choices are. But what are you trying to do? Everybody that does everything in life, you try to get a basic core need met. You're not trying to hurt anybody. You're trying to get a basic core need met. You don't know how to do it. So I go with what I know.
And if you have a history of that core need not being met, the last thing you want to do is extend yourself and be vulnerable to only have that happen again. So why not withdrawal?
Well,
it's better than the pain of rejection, right?
Well, yeah, but you know what's really easy? You know what's a million times easier than this? Having a feeling and opening up and letting it go. That's really easy.
So what should you have done in that situation?
That's really easy.
Walked out in your pajamas and said, "Hi, Frenchie."
I could have said, "Hi, Frenchie, and I need a ride."
Yeah.
Because I haven't been out in a few days.
Yeah.
But I would have fixed my hair. Does anybody realize how hard, I mean, how difficult it is to be depressed? Yeah. How difficult it is to depress what naturally wants to come up and out? What you're doing is you're holding a piano. It's like a jack-in-the-box. You're holding all this shit in that wants to just come out. It's not trying to hurt you.
So why doesn't it come out?
because the brain says this is bad for you, it will hurt you, and you could die from this.
And people won't love you if they know this is inside you.
Yeah, yeah. There's something wrong. Just the fact that it's here, there's something wrong, because it makes you feel uncomfortable, and it means something. Yeah. This feeling means something, so I must understand. It means something. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean anything. It's a feeling. When a kid has a feeling, they're upset one minute and they're happy the next.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that's what feelings are. It doesn't mean anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in the moment. And the other thing is, through entertainment, you know, I'm trying to do these shows that unite self-help and comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we do this show called Acting Out, and it basically is...
Brilliant idea.
Well, it's so much fun.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. It's guests act out their real life issues with a therapist and a panel of comedic actors, and it's therapeutic role play. So emotional Who's Line is kind of what it is. And
Describe it a little more, because I think for somebody that hasn't heard that yet, they can't picture exactly how it goes down.
A guest comes on. Okay, I'm on the stage. There's a guest.
You're the host.
I'm the host, and there's a guest who comes on, and I talk to them about real life issues. What's going on in their real life. A woman comes on and she says, I'm really upset. I said, well, what's happening? She says, well, I hate my mom. And I just got off the phone with her and I can't stand her. And I said, well, you know, you think it's ever going to change? What will you do with this situation? Yeah, it'll change. It'll change in a funeral home. All right, the therapist is on stage with me. There's a panel of comedic actors. The therapist says, well, you're in luck today. This is your lucky day. Because this is a funeral home. And I'm going to ask one of our panelists, Moon Zappa, to come over and lay down in this grave right here and be your mom, and now you get to do the eulogy. Now, these are funny people. Tears are now pouring down this woman's face. Your friend and mine, Jimmy Pardo, is on the panel. Jimmy looks over at the way that Moon Zappa is laying down in the grave, and he says, why is Moon Zappa laying in a grave like she's a guest star on CSI Miami? Why is that happening? The audience is now roaring. They have seen somebody bawl their eyes out, and now they're laughing. Within the next 10 minutes, this woman will play her mother, her daughter, herself at different ages. The other panelists will help her with different parts of her life. And in 10 minutes, she's going to have a different relationship with her mom, and her mom's not there.
Wow.
So that's what it is.
So the comedians that are a part of it, they play different roles of people in that panelist's life.
Yeah, you might, but everyone is different. We never know exactly what's going to happen.
Is there the comedian's role solely to bring levity to it?
Nope. The comedian's role is to help the person.
So it's really kind of, the ball is in their court, is to decide when to try to be serious and when to try to be funny.
Well, the therapist is guiding the whole thing. I mean, I work with a guy who's been doing this for 40 years. He used to work with John Lennon. I mean, the guy is amazing.
Pete Best.
Yes. And he was upset for about 35 of those years. But for 5 years, he said, I'm going to start doing this therapy and maybe they'll help me. And his incessant drumming. There's nothing worse than space drumming, too. There's no drum there. But no, he's very good at it. And it's therapeutic. It's not, you know, the comedy comes out of it, but it's not comedic to be comedic. Whereas you have, you know, The Marriage Ref and things like that. These are comedic to be comedic. We're not helping anybody. We don't want to help anybody. We're not interested in anybody.
Right.
We want to be funny. Well, this is uniting comedy and emotion. And this is...
To me, that's the best comedy, is the stuff that comes from someplace really kind of deep and painful.
There's nothing... But when you have both of them, what happens is I look at the audience, they come to life.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of a sudden, people who are depressed and they have no energy and it's like, how long is this show going to be? They don't leave.
Yeah. How often do you do the show and where do you do it?
Well, I used to do it at, I did it in San Francisco for a little bit, and I did it here in LA at a place called the Actors Art Theater, a little theater. And then I did it at the Improv, and now we're pitching it to TV. I mean, it's a TV show. And around it is a company that I'm starting. It's called Commotion. It stands for Comedy and Emotion. And it's a company that produces and creates and develops self-help, unites self-help and comedy throughout all media. Little self-help tools that you can use, mm-hmm. that are really simple, like, you know, when I'm feeling afraid, I can actually welcome it. I might actually try that. And if I'm feeling all this crap, I could ask myself a question. Would I rather feel the way I'm feeling right now, or would I rather be free? And as soon as you ask yourself that question in your head, it goes away. Now it may come back, but it gives you what it gives you is a perspective that, oh my God, there's something I can do. Mm-hmm. I just had this thing and it went away for a second.
You know, for me though, sometimes that's not enough to get the feeling to go away. I can recognize that I'm trapped in my mind, but still, like this morning, I'm just in a funk and doing all the stuff I'm supposed to do, you know, reading the books that help me and meditating, and still couldn't shake this feeling of doom and obsessing about whether is this feeling that I have, is this something I have control over, or is this my physical chemical depression, and this is just on a downward spiral.
Yep. You know? I know it well. No, well, I mean, there are.
So does that mean that I was experiencing something that's beyond my control?
Yeah, yeah. But you know, like sitting down, you know, if I have that stuff come up and I sit down, and often I don't do this, and I say, okay, this is what's going on right now. What seals that stuff in is it should not be going on right now. What's going on right now is not okay.
Right.
That's what keeps it going. What's going on right now is not okay. Instead of, you know, I'm feeling doom now. Could I welcome the doom? Yes. Okay. Let me sit with the doom.
Yeah. I have such a hard time doing that. And that's not the first time I've heard somebody suggest that. And I've done it before, but it's so hard to go in the direct. It's like turning into the fishtail.
It's
counterintuitive.
Well, it's only hard because we've been practicing something else our whole lives. It's practice. So now we're practicing. You know, it's like saying I'm going to dribble the basketball with my right hand for 40 years, and now I'm going to go with my left. Oh, I can't do this. This is horrible. I can't really dribble with my left. Certainly not as well as with my right. Well, it's hard to unlearn, to undo something, but it's actually confoundingly simple. It's so simple, it's the brain can't accept it. It's so simple. How could it be that simple? Well, it's that simple.
Because our problems and our feelings feel so large and overwhelming, we almost refuse to believe that a solution, a temporary solution, could be that simple and that easy.
Because I'm controlling it, and so it makes it bigger. Because I'm controlling it, and I'm a human being that's walking around with all this these trapped feelings that have never been let out.
Do you feel like doing a fear off?
Yeah.
Okay. I mentioned earlier on the show this wonderful woman named Christine, who sent me this really nice email that really picked my spirits up today. And I think only if you're depressed and full of fear can you not be offended by the idea that I felt better by seeing how scared somebody else is.
There's company.
Because on the surface, it sounds kind of mean and vindictive, but it's...
It's perspective. This is what we all do to ourselves, and here's the list.
Yes. So she writes, this list is in no way comprehensive. Just decided this morning to start writing down my fears as they came up. So this covers about 12 hours of my day. And then she goes to list like,
holy, I didn't realize you had a second page.
There's three pages.
There's
three pages, single spaced.
You got it. That's fantastic.
She will defeat you. She will probably defeat the next two guests.
She's the champ.
But her fears are so, I'll just read them because I just became such a fan of this woman reading this. All right, I'll kick off with her first fear. I'm afraid my bowels will never work normally again.
She's not alone there.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that the pants I'm wearing will offend other people who aren't here.
Seriously?
Yeah.
I don't understand that one.
I don't either.
You're afraid that the pants you are wearing will offend people that aren't here.
Yeah.
How could they be offended by them if they're not here?
Well, I think of family that isn't here, and I think of other people that aren't here, and I think they wouldn't be happy seeing me the way I am.
Oh, because you've got a rip in your jeans?
Yeah.
At first I thought you were being funny.
No.
But you're being serious.
Yeah.
She says, I'm afraid I'll never find joy in daily life.
I'm afraid that I won't find joy in this minute, in this moment, and it means that I'm never going to be happy.
I'm afraid I'll screw up my kids because of my mental illness.
I'm afraid that what my daughter is learning most is how to be a depressed, a balding Jew.
I'm afraid my kids will inherit my mental illness.
I'm afraid that the meek will inherit the earth.
I'm afraid my kids will inherit IBS. IBS is irritable bowel syndrome, for those of you that don't know.
Yeah.
And I had it in my 20s.
Oh, did you?
Not fucking fun.
Not fun.
Yeah. Constant bloating and stomach aches, and you're either constipated or you got diarrhea.
I think that is what I have, but I haven't had a name for it until now. I'm afraid that I'm going to die, and I'm afraid that I'm going to live.
I'm afraid our paychecks will never last more than a week, even though we only get paid every 2 weeks.
I am afraid that I will never be able to eat any food without having an allergic reaction and feeling horrible.
I'm afraid every charity and organization we like will shut down because we and people like us didn't have enough money to donate to them.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I have that one too.
Okay, this is not mine, but it's so good. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, her mother, when Kennedy was assassinated, was on the toilet at the time and was afraid that she would have to tell people when they asked her where she was when Kennedy was shot that she was on the toilet, that she, in her mind at that time, got off the toilet because she had that fear. How far ahead do you have to think? One day people are going to say, where were you when Kennedy was shot? And I'm going to say, I was on the toilet. Okay, I better get off the toilet now. Now.
So that's it. So she wasn't done on the toilet. She got off so that she could say she was somewhere else.
Yes.
Oh my God, that's fantastic. Christine says, I'm afraid I will never fulfill my husband sexually.
I have the same fear about your husband. No, okay, I could. I'm not going to say it because I'll get in trouble. But I.
There's no trouble.
No, there's trouble. No, I'm not going to say it. That's okay.
Now you have to say it.
Oh, I'm. You know, I can't say this. I'm afraid that I'll. This is bad. You know, I always carry around this fear. I'm afraid that I'll never be able. I'll never be touched again.
That's a great fear to let come up. That's not an easy thing to say.
Well, it'll be, it won't be easy in court when I'm taken in by my wife. No, it's not going to be easy when the battle happens. No, it is. It's very difficult to say, you know, and I was that way when I was, you know, I wasn't, I wasn't intimate with people, and then I got into a relationship. It was my first real serious, like, living with somebody relationship, and we're in the middle of having sex, and I was paralyzed because I wasn't used to being touched.
When was this?
A long time ago, but it's a vivid memory. It's a very vivid memory because I was in love with this person, and it just sort of happened like that. And then, being a comedian, I was lucky enough that I saved myself with doing some kind of a Woody Allen impression. Mm-hmm. And I really did.
So did you wind up becoming comfortable being touched?
Yeah, yeah.
And are you comfortable being touched to this day?
Yeah, yeah.
But so, you're afraid that feeling is going to come back.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And it goes along with intimacy. Yes. It goes along with intimacy. Yeah.
I think very few marriages exist that aren't going through some type of little snag at some point. I think it's just how big the snags are.
Well, yeah, and if you have the foundation that you've built, that you can listen to each other, and I'm learning how to do it.
And diplomatically express what you're feeling instead of expressing it as blame on what the other person is doing. That has been the biggest gift for me in keeping my marriage going and being a decent husband. Instead of saying, you know, you did this and that's wrong, I'll say, you know, when this happens, it makes me feel this way and I don't want to feel that way. I want to feel closer to you and I don't know what to do. And then the ball is just out in the air and she's not cornered by me blaming her. I've expressed how I felt. So it allows her a chance to come towards me. Whereas if I'm just blaming, I've pushed her back into a corner. She has no choice but to be defensive. You know,
it's I instead of you.
Yeah. And if you really love somebody, you shouldn't want to win an argument with them. That's not, how is that love? You know,
but it took me 15 years to
realize that. All right.
Practice. Yeah.
Christine says, I turned the page prematurely.
This is amazing. I just want to paint this, but I want to say what's happening here. There are three pages, and he's DuPaul just turned to the second page,
yeah.
And it is probably like a 10 or 12 font, and the page is complete. It looks like the Torah. It's completely filled with words.
And this was just 12 hours of her day. She wrote this down as her fears come out. And I absolutely am as fearful as she is. So I totally get this. And I can't tell you how happy this makes me. Not that she's going through this, but that I have... and finding other people that feel this way and that aren't afraid to share it with somebody. This is the feeling I've been looking for my whole life, because it's just...
connection.
Yeah. And she says, I'm afraid I will give in and have a three-way with my husband and regret it for the rest of my life.
Here's my fear. This is a big fear for me, is that my daughter is never going to really know me.
That's a great one. Christine says, I'm afraid I'll shit myself in the middle of a crowd with no bathroom nearby.
I peed in a fashion show. Yeah, I was like five. I was in first grade, and they had a fashion show for some reason. And I walked out, and I saw the people there, and I urinated all over the stage.
Did you really?
Well, I was just marking my territory. I was a very wolfish kid. No, I did. Yeah, sure, I did.
I'm gonna be that psychiatrist and give you the stone face while we're going through the fear list when you try to lighten it up with your jokes. At least until I get the feeling that you're, because I get the feeling that you're being a little not defensive, but I'm just getting a feeling that you're...
I'm afraid of it.
Yes, yes. That you're afraid of the fear off.
Correct.
So I'll use that as your fear, and I'll give her her next one. And I'm sorry if that seemed judgmental of me saying that.
Well, it happens to be true.
It just felt like it was getting in the way of us...
The real,
Getting this flowing.
Sure.
And know, by the way, that I have listed a gazillion of my fears. I'm currently out because I've listed so many. It's not that I don't have fears. My list is about four times of what she has.
Sure.
She says, I'm afraid my kids will be with me, when this happens, when she shits herself in the middle of a crowd.
Wow.
And I'll do another one that she has. I'm afraid I will screw up my relationship with my kids so bad that I won't get to spend time with my grandchildren.
She has fear forwarding, which is great. Mm-hmm. I like her fear forwarding. I'll say, you know, with me, it's just basically it's a fear of not being known for who I am, and it's a fear of never living fully as myself in any moment.
That is a great one to not only be aware of, but to express. And when I started expressing things like that in my life began to change for the better. And I think everybody has that one. And that's a good one. Christine says, I'm afraid I will be a medical receptionist for the rest of my life, starting over every time we move to a new city.
Yeah, I'm afraid that I will never allow myself to do the kind of work that I want to do or meant to do.
I'm going to do a couple of hers, because she's just got so many. I'm afraid I'll never finish college. I'm afraid I'll finish college with student loans I can never pay back. I'm afraid I'll get a degree and won't be able to find a job in that field.
You can go on with hers, because she's great.
Okay, all right. I'm afraid I'll get a degree... I'm afraid I'll get a degree, get the job I dreamed of, and hate it. I'm afraid I will always be fat. I'm afraid people will think I'm stupid because of my weight. I'm afraid my husband will find me when I'm hiding and eating. I'm afraid someone will hear when I make myself throw up. I just fucking love this woman. Her honesty is is so awesome.
It's incredible.
Well, yeah. I'm gonna save her her fears for another fear off.
When I was a kid, I remember being in, it was fall, and I remember being under a pile of leaves, and I remember like looking up at the sky, and I've had these moments all throughout my life, and I'm sure you people have too. And I heard the voices of kids traveling through the air, and I heard the noises in the neighborhood, and I didn't want for anything. I was 100% happy. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking about the future. I wasn't thinking about past. It just sort of happened. I never forgot it. And I've had a string of those kind of moments when I don't want for anything and I'm there. And that is the state of the world. That is how things are. Everything else is a resistance of that, is a something on top of that. But that is how things are all the time. The lights are always on. But, you know,
why is it so easy to forget that, and why is it so hard to get to that place?
You want it to last, and yeah. if it doesn't, then there's something wrong, and then we're gonna control, and then everything has meaning.
So is the place to get back there then what you were saying, which is to embrace that feeling, and that's the road back to it, not fighting it.
Yeah. And allow there to be space around it. You know, like make
what
it
do you a, mean what do you mean by that?
I mean revel in it. I mean like be there, enjoy it.
Don't think like I shouldn't be wasting my time in this pile of leaves. I got that thing.
Why am I wasting my time? Why am I here enjoying this walk? I got rent to pay. Well, you're not paying it right now, are you? Mm-hmm. You're on your walk. Might as well enjoy your walk. When you get back, you can worry about paying the rent. Because it's going to be there. You know, whatever is. But it's not happening now. When I'm here talking to you, I'm sitting on a very comfortable couch, talking to a great guy, having a great time. I'm not dying. Nothing that I'm projecting in my head is happening. It's not happening now. So why live it? It's not happening now.
Yeah.
And when I get in the car, I'll be in the car. And then what will happen then will happen then.
I want to go shut my dog up.
Sure.
Can you hear my dog barking
in
the background?
I can, but what I heard.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to embrace my dog barking in the background.
You embrace your dog, and what I'll do is I'm going to take a look at the other fears that this woman has, and I'm going to actually, and I'm going to see if I can find her number. Because she is somebody that you want to talk to. I do. Anybody who can be that open.
Yeah. I just love that email, and anybody out there that's listening, if you're full of fear, start writing them down and email them to me, and maybe we'll use them on the fear off. I've had a bunch of listeners send me fears, and hopefully I'll get to them at some point. I can't promise I will, but I just love when the listeners connect to the show like that.
Well, I look at the website and I think, you know, people are really, they're really connecting and they're getting to talk about stuff that they don't have a place for. And if you're doing that, you're doing something great. I mean, I admire what you're doing. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Well, thanks, Ed. I appreciate that. Anything you want to share with us before we wrap it up?
I'm a size 6 cocktail dress. I got to get back to my Butterfield 8 weight. I have an hourglass figure and time is running out. I'm a lazy Susan of love. I'm the James Brown of depression. I'm the Ken Burns of depression. I don't know. I guess that's it. I'm a trophy wife.
You're the Ken Burns of depression. So when you talk about somebody abusing you as a child, you like to have Louis Armstrong playing in the background.
I do. It all goes back to Louis Armstrong and the Negro Leagues.
Yeah.
Baseball in some way. Somebody was done wrong. I know that somebody was done wrong, and Louis Armstrong is usually playing in the background. And also, Ken Burns is in my house. He's in my room, and he's actually editing while I'm living. But he still has that bowl haircut, doesn't he?
He does.
He's great. He's a genius.
He really is.
Yeah.
Ed Krasnick, I want to thank you for coming by.
A pleasure. All right. Pleasure.
Many thanks to Ed Krasnick for being so open and honest and so funny. He has a new show called the Self-Help Comedy Hour, and it is streams live every Sunday, and it's archived at wreckingballradio.com. So be sure to check that out. Before I take it out with a couple of surveys and an email,
I want to remind you guys that there's a couple of different ways to support the show. You can support it financially by going to the website, mentalpod.com, and either making a one-time PayPal donation, or my favorite, a recurring monthly donation, which brings me a little closer to my dream of having this be my full-time gig. You can also support it by using our Amazon search portal. It's on the right-hand side of the homepage, about halfway down. And if you enter through there, anything you buy on Amazon, Amazon gives us a couple nickels and it doesn't cost you anything. You can also support the show non-financially by going to iTunes, giving us a good rating. Boosts our ranking, brings more people to the show. We like that. And also by spreading the word through social media. So I would appreciate anybody doing that. And also, if you would care to be a transcriber, we've had a lot of people sign up lately and are busy at work transcribing past episodes. So I want to give a shout out to those people and say thank you so much. I want to read an email from a listener named Deckard who writes, I'm a straight male in his late 20s and I have a very close friend who is just 4 years younger than me. She and I have been close friends for about 5 years and I think the world of her. We're always hanging out and we will talk for hours every day. I realized a couple of months ago that I had strong romantic feelings for my friend. I found myself thinking about her more and more, and eventually, I decided to tell her how I felt. I've never been more nervous in my entire life. I was literally shaking as I told, which I'm sure was very attractive. Well, I told her how I felt, and she turned me down in the kindest and most mature way possible. She told me that she loved me as a friend, and she stressed that she would want to remain friends, if at all possible. My initial gut reaction was to feel angry and embarrassed. I wanted to hate her for denying me, and I wanted to go make her like me because I deserved it after being alone for so long. This thought lasted about 2 seconds before I realized that none of that was true. I didn't hate her. I loved her too much for that. I just thought that was so beautiful and mature for somebody in their 20s to be able to come to that intellectually and emotionally. I just thought that was beautiful, so I wanted to share that with you guys. This survey I want to read is from the Shame and Secrets survey, and it was filled out by a woman who calls herself Katie Quixotic. She is straight. She's in her 20s, was raised in an environment that was a little dysfunctional. You ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts as sexual abuse. Dated and regretfully had sex with an 18-year-old when I was only 14. Deepest, darkest thoughts. Something attracts me about, quote, being taken care of by a rich older man. That and having really rough sex, slapping a guy across the face, scratching, biting, being tied down and letting him give me orders. Deepest, darkest secrets. My freshman year of high school when I was 14, I dated an 18-year-old high school dropout loser. I would lie to my parents about where I was going and ride my bike to his house. We engaged in oral sex, dry humping, and after 4 months I lost my virginity. It was on his dad's bed and it only lasted for a few minutes, but it was a defining moment for me. It was a defining moment for the negative self-image I would carry throughout adolescence and early adulthood. I was no longer that bright, cheery, innocent, world at her feet Katie. I was now a different kind of girl. I was damaged. At 25, I want to tell 14-year-old me to go to class, value your mind and your education, ask questions, surround yourself with people who make you feel smart, and encourage you to be better. And lastly, your boundaries and opinions matter because they're yours. I would love to have that put in a textbook that all kids in middle school would read. I don't know if they would listen to it or not, because sometimes I think you have to experience those things to get that kind of perspective, but get so many people that fill the survey out that dated somebody inappropriately older than them when they were 13, 14 years old, and it really has really kind of fucks them up. This is also from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a guy who calls himself UGH, U-G-H. He is bisexual. Well, he says bisexual, I don't know. He's in his 20s, was raised in an environment that was pretty dysfunctional, never been sexually abused. Deepest, darkest thoughts. I have sexual fantasies where I am a woman, woman parts and all, being dominated by a strong, assertive man. Although I am a progressive person, the thought is still deeply troubling. Deepest, darkest secrets. Growing up, I was physically and emotionally abused by a family member. You know, it just occurred to me that have you ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Have you ever been the victim of physical, sexual, or emotional abuse? Because they all really kind of have equally negative impact. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. I have a crazy range of sexual fantasies with varying power dynamics, sexual orientations, and genders, meaning where I am myself, a man, and others where I am a woman. It feels so weird to physically write this out. What the fuck, me? I get that when people are filling out the surveys, that there is something that happens when you see your words written out that gives you a perspective that is really valuable, I think. But I think he's being way too hard on himself. Would you ever consider telling a partner or close friend? He writes, no, it just feels too bizarre, taboo. Maybe a special partner one day. Did these secrets and thoughts generate any particular feelings towards yourself? He writes, I'm not sure. Part of me weirdly takes pride in my complex sexual identity, as if I'm now more interesting or equally complex. Anyways, I know this isn't the case. Any comments or suggestions to make the podcast better? In capital letters, make it an hour long. I love your podcast, but 90 plus minutes is a killer. I apologize about that. There are people that enjoy the length that it is. And if I could get everything that I wanted to say and have my guest say in an hour, I would have it be an hour, but I can't. And I just want to say that line where you say, part of me weirdly takes pride in my complex sexual identity. Try to make that the whole you, because I think we are all, like Greg Barrett says, you know, we're all beautiful in some fucked up weird way. And I'm not calling you weird, but your feelings about yourself, you feel like you're weird. And I think what is unique about all of us, we feel that that makes us weird, but it doesn't. It doesn't. And I know I'm preaching to the choir out there, but I just wanted to send a hug your way. The last thing I want to read is from the Happy Moments survey. And this was filled out by a guy named Cam, who is gay, and he's in his 20s, was raised in a stable and safe environment, and describe, share one or two of your happiest moments. They don't have to be huge. He writes, there's a lot of backstory here, but for the sake of brevity, I came out as gay to my parents at 19. They took it terribly, rather conservative religious folk. I actively kept my distance for around a year. Things were slowly patched up. On my 20th birthday, I was incredibly down. Alone at my apartment, dealing with issues both at college and at work, with no one around that I knew or could talk to in any deep aspect. My mind was in a very scared place in terms of my future. I heard a knock on my door, and to my surprise, it was my mother with a cake and a pint of ice cream and a bundle of balloons. I broke down and cried. We spent the next few hours talking over everything, from my sexuality to my anxieties about my future career to how the family was. Just the fact that she drove all the way out to my apartment to make sure I had a good 20th was so incredibly helpful to me. I will never forget it. It sounds childish, but I don't care. I don't think it sounds childish at all. I think it sounds fucking beautiful. And I can never hear enough stuff like that. So, anybody out there that's feeling weird, broken, misfit, whatever word you want to use, wishing that you were different, what would happen if just for the next 24 hours you embraced your uniqueness and stopped caring what other people thought of you? Maybe I should try doing that. If you're out there and you're alone and you're struggling, you're really not alone, because we are everywhere. You may not be able to see it on someone's face, but if we could turn our insides inside out, you would be shocked to see how many people feel just the way that you do. Thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.